Okay, welcome to another exciting episode of Shooting the Shit with Shane. And once again, my co-host Larry is not here today. He's back in Orange County. I, however, am in San Marcos here with the lead guitarist of Reason to Rebel, Evan Jones, and one of my friends. And, to give everyone a little back history about us, we did graduate together in the same graduating class at Cal State Fullerton, right?
Just this past semester. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cal State Fullerton.
yeah, that was it. I mean, you have always been really, really talented with editing. It's one of your, possibly hidden skills for most people, because most people see you on stage and everything and think, okay, guitarist. But you're actually a very talented editor in your own right.
Yeah, I appreciate that, but, I'm still young in that game. I've only been doing it for about, really, two years. And, I've learned a lot, definitely there's ways to edit something and ways not to. So it's like you make your mistakes and you just get better. And
yeah.
It's always kept me interested. So I've never, things that you want to do, no matter how hard they are the things that you're gonna love to do.
Yeah.
So.
'Cause I know, I've edited my stuff and everything, and I'm just, very basic with stuff, And then when I was doing my short film Henchman, the first cut right now is up on YouTube at, youtube.com/ShaneShanePI. That's where you can find that. But right now, we are sort of still working on a new cut of it, because Evan here, he's talented. I said this to Evan, and I think I've told a few people before, him to editing is like me on the keyboard, typing with two index fingers, and that's it. Click, 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 click. While Evan here is doing the full typing with both hands and everything, Not even looking at the screen while he's doing it. He's that to editing as I am to typing,
I don't know. It's been a lot of fun. I've definitely enjoyed it.
So. Yeah. I mean, it's just something that just seems to come natural to you. I mean, I know it took a lot of hard work and everything, but yeah, it's you just know where all the controls are and everything. And part of that has to do with owning a Mac, which, I don't. I'm a PC, as we are recording this on my PC or laptop as it is,
Yeah. I mean, I did it all at Fullerton, back before I even had my own computer.
Yeah, and then you ended up buying a new Mac computer for yourself for your editing, because you knew that would be something that you need in the future and all that.
That's true.
Yeah, are you thinking of doing anything narrative-based, like any sort of drama or comedy or anything aside from just, editing footage of bands or your bands and other bands?
Well, I mean, I really enjoy acting as well, so there's a couple things that are happening. We're currently writing a screenplay for a series we're calling The Desert Chronicles.
Ooh.
And I actually will be playing a side character and doing more of the,
What's your character's name?
Pre-production. I don't really would have a name. I think the way this world is going to unfold, there's going to be a lot of surprises and tricks and a lot of things that are not really, pertaining to society today.
Yeah. So that's what it's kind of about. It's a post-apocalyptic, set in the future, sort of, influenced by movies like Mad Max and Blade Runner, and maybe, movies set in the desert, like The Book of Eli, or...
I think in the end, we're just trying to make a good drama, but... But definitely the setting and, the way the characters are going to bounce off each other is really... what we're going for here, not so much telling of a time, but telling of a story that hopefully just holds deep.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's really the great thing about good science fiction. You notice it in movies like Moon and, Blade Runner and everything. It's not really about the actual, robots or aliens or future and everything like that. It's really the human struggle inside of that story,
True.
And the sci-fi is just a good backdrop for that story. I mean, that's because, everyone says, oh, sci-fi, they mean Star Wars, robots, aliens, fighting, this and that and everything. But no, there is really a true, a human story element underneath it. Look at, say, District 9. We were watching a bit of that before that, It's it's about aliens landing on Earth and being sort of refugees and the animosity against them, a racism sort of, you know, it's all about it's really a human struggle beyond the alien backdrop setting.
I think as a movie maker or a writer or of some sorts, I can see how the settings and all that can almost yield so much more drama when you have more control or when you're allowing your setting to be as fantastic as possible.
Yeah.
There is, just more creative control, and it's been amazing. So I've been enjoying the screenwriting process. That's great.
Yeah. So what is the story behind the Desert Chronicles?
Well, it's kind of...
Yeah. If you don't have to give spoilers or anything, because I know the movie is upcoming, but what's the...
I really can't say, per se right now.
No. Come on, give us some details, you know?
Well, I mean, it's a story of, a young female. So that's the protagonist. I think that's as much as I can say.
You guys know that one about the movie starring the female?
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a little bit of, she's, let's just say she's a valuable prize among the society that she lives in, you know? She's a rare commodity in that world. In that sense. So, people are after her. Good guys are after her. Bad guys are after her. Is that kind of the gist? Sort of a bit like Waterworld, you know? I don't want to debase it down to Waterworld. But, you know, Kevin Costner in that movie. He was,
We'll see. You know, it's like there's a lot of... it's not really, as far as I'm concerned, I'm not, liberty to talk about it because, it's very young in the process. Yeah. So it's like, it's almost like a movie will change so many times before you even know it. All of a sudden it's a movie about something completely different. There's amazing steps that we all are taking, mm-hmm. when we make a movie, because...
yeah, I mean...
On set, pre-production, post-production.
I mean, as far as the gist of the story, I mean, it's not something that people can just steal, because, I mean, at its core, it's a simple story, mm-hmm. I don't want to debase it or anything. Don't let it seem like I'm being derogatory, but all movies start at a simple core, but they have a lot more complexities and subtleties beyond the basic story. I mean, there is the second story going on that isn't really up front. It's the inner struggle within the characters. It's the it's the wants and desires of many people. And I'm sure there is going to be a moral complexity, because I'm sure the bad guys need the quote unquote bad guys need that person for a reason. The good guys need her for another reason.
That's like not the only really thing that I really am doing right now either. So it's like, I'm not trying to, say that that's the only thing I'm doing, but yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. But this seems to be the most like prominent thing you're really doing, the big thing.
Just kind of in the baby stages right now. Can't really say too much about it.
Well, if you need somebody to get shot at, I'm always here for that.
I appreciate that.
Yes. I make a great corpse. It's the hardest part that no one knows about.
Excellent. I've played that role many times.
Yeah. I know, because I was watching that movie Source Code, and I was watching some of the behind the scenes part about it, and the gist of the story is that Jake Gyllenhaal goes back to his train, and it's like the same train but it's different for 8 minutes, so people are the same, everything they do is the same, because he has to kind of go back, figure out who the bomber is who bombed the train. It's sort of a alternate reality simulation type thing. And the filmmakers were saying that this one guy on the train set had the hardest job, because throughout the whole scene, whole 8 minutes, he's asleep. And so for hours and hours on set, he just has to lean against the window and pretend to be asleep while everyone else is running around, shooting guns, chasing people, tackling people.
That's a tough job.
Everything like that. Yeah, and he's just got to be the fat guy who's asleep next to the window. it wouldn't seem that hard. It seems like, oh, dude, I'll take that job. I'll pretend to be asleep. Yeah. But when you're doing it for like 20 hours straight and everything, it gets at you, It's hard to maintain your...
Pretty bad.
Yeah. And then we talked about your tour. Your first tour is here in Oceanside, right? And then you're moving on to San Antonio, Texas, right?
No, I'm moving up the coast. We're doing San Jose,
that's right.
To Seattle. All across the United States. Okay. So look out for us. Our tour is gonna be...
Do you have a favorite venue you like to play at?
Oh, favorite venue. I really enjoy playing in. I guess it's more or less just the places, I guess. I really enjoy Jumping Turtle. It's always been fun.
Jumping Turtle, where are they at?
That's our local bar.
Oh, that's nice, fun, your local bar. You know, have I been to that
any
one?
Any show is just amazing fun. Mm.
Yeah, I'm sure the crowds, because the great thing about being a small band is that the people who come out to see you are already kind of fans on your music. You know, it's not like you have to sell them on you as much.
You meet someone new every day, so it's pretty cool, you know, that, you know, it just continues to grow.
Yeah. And have you felt the fan base is growing for your band?
Definitely, for sure.
Like, is it growing slowly or is it increasing faster than you expected?
I think we're on an up and up right now. You know, a lot of things are going to be coming out. You know, mm-hmm. I think the vibe is getting real big, and you know, there's a lot going on this new record. So I'm excited about it.
You know, do you have fans on Facebook? Do you know how many people?
For sure.
How many fans you have?
I couldn't tell you, but I mean, I don't really run the Facebook. You know.
So, how long are you staying in each town for before you move on to the next one? Do you play multiple gigs in the same venue in town, or do you do one gig per city and then you go on to the next one?
We have in the past, but this tour we're going to be basically moving as fast as possible, hitting up as many places in as short amount of time as possible.
Yeah.
So, I mean, unless we're making money and then probably maybe once or twice in the middle of a week.
Yeah.
During this 5-week tour, we'll probably do two shows in one place,
mm-hmm.
or a city close to it.
Because at that point,
this one's going to be pretty fast paced.
Yeah, I can imagine. Because at that point, it's pretty much straight profit when you're already in the town, you already got your gig set up and everything. You know, because you account into travel expenses versus doing the show and the profit you get from that. So if you're doing two shows at the same venue, you know, it's straight profit at that point. You've already covered your expenses from the first one.
In the past, you know, we have, when we were traveling for 2 months or more,
mm-hmm.
we would have a couple days where we would either stay with family of the band, of a band member or such. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, one time in Chicago, we came there, we only had one show booked. We ended up booking two more. We were staying there for 4 days, you know.
Very nice.
So that was, it was an amazing time. Chicago was a lot of fun, you know.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine that. Yeah,
it always is. Yeah.
Mm. Chicago's a beautiful city. I've seen it. I haven't been there, but I've seen a few movies where it takes place in there, and it just seems like a great, like, metropolitan city. It's like a nice mix between L.A. and New York, you know?
I had a great veggie burrito there.
Nice. The food is always one of those hallmarks of a great city. It's like, is Chicago known for their any sort of specialty? I know they have deep dish pizza. I'm sure their deep dish pizza is pretty amazing over there.
Definitely.
Have you had anything you'd recommend if I ever go there? Any restaurants that's really good for their deep dish pizza?
Well, I mean, not necessarily any restaurants, but some bars that have some pretty tall drinks.
Nice.
That's what I can recommend.
Yeah. You go to the places which have the yard tall beers, you know?
Yes.
Yeah, those are
the whiskey cokes.
The whiskey cokes, huh?
That are in a mug, a very tall mug. It was awesome.
Nice, very cool. All right. Well, yeah, let's get on to some other topics. You know, let's talk about some stuff. I know, like, really, I should be doing like news stories and everything, stuff that's more relevant. But you know, me with the research, I should be doing more research. But yeah, not really. So let's see. Let's talk about solar powered cars, you know?
Cool.
Because I think that's something that we should have, like, by now really done, you know? We should have already finished with the solar car experimentation, you know? If it was really a priority, we would probably have good working solar powered cars for now. Because, I mean, you know, they've been working on solar powered cars since the 70s, you know? I mean, the sun doesn't really change that much, you know? And so right now, all we have are still like really flat cars that don't really hold anything and don't have much power. They can go fast on a really flat surface, but as far as that, it hasn't really advanced more than that. And by this time, I was kind of hoping that solar powered cars would be at that stage where like hybrid cars are at right now, where they're on the verge of coming out and they're at the verge of being profitable and everything like that. I mean, what do you think about
Solar power is definitely, it's the future. And I mean, from what I've,
you know, read in the past and done reports on, you know, there has been a lot more programs that are happening, and well, at least basically states are being able to fund solar programs that will ensure that so much power will be saved, and basically it leaves a homeowner to over a course of 10 years, you could possibly be making money, you know.
Oh, really?
Or saving money, at least.
Like, you could be banking power through the solar panels in your house and then selling that at a profit to electric companies or, you know.
Well, just neighboring houses or
houses
somewhat,
in your block,
you know, I mean, there's communities that are trying to come together and
That's
have a whole solar community of houses.
Yeah,
you know, and that's basically where it's happening. But you know, any homeowner, you know, there are programs to have your house solar panels.
Yeah. That's one thing that really has done well, you know, so far, is really the solar panels on the house. Because if you think about it, if you're building a new house, you'd be crazy not to put solar panels. I mean, you know, it's free energy at that point. You're saving money on your AC bill in the summer, and it's like the sun's there, you might as well take it, you know? It's like picking up money on the ground, you know?
It's not, you know, it is expensive, but...
That's true.
But,
that's true.
You know, if you can afford it, it's a great trend, and I hope a lot of people that, you know, can't afford that think about that.
It should become a new trend with new houses being built, because they're always building new houses, and that should be an option that they should give homeowners, saying, do you want solar panel power, which will save you, like, you know, at least five times the amount of money that you put into putting a new solar panels in, you know? And there is government rebates and all that, and that really offers it out for you.
I mean, with that, it's like there's so many, you know, basically power plants that you could possibly, you know, we could shut down for good, you know, that would be amazing. You know, I mean, every couple months they have to take a huge fucking shell of nuclear power, basically nuclear waste anyway, from this power plant right here.
I hear nuclear power isn't as bad as we've all really grown up to think it is, because if you think about it, like submarines, aircraft carriers and all that, they run on nuclear power, you know? Clean burning fuel, because imagine if you had an aircraft carrier and you had to run that on gasoline. Yeah. Imagine how the output of that. It's like moving a skyscraper full of gasoline, you know?
In the end, you know, it's still dangerous.
Yeah, there is a few risks, but compared to say coal mining, the amount of risks that come with that, you know, if you think about the coal miners that got trapped down the mine, the coal miners that die from black lung, you know, lung cancer, things like that. It's like the death toll for nuclear power, despite, you know, a couple meltdowns and everything, the death toll has been much less than a coal mining incidents, you know,
past. Kind of just saw what happened with Japan, you know.
Japan thing was really a tsunami, you know, more so than nuclear power.
Yeah, but, well, that's, you know, that's part of it, you know. Say a tsunami hit, you know, San Diego coast.
Yeah. A tsunami could hit San Diego's coast and everything, but... I mean, that doesn't really have much to do with nuclear power in itself, you know? Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's true. You could have a nuclear power plant, could get hit by a natural disaster and just melt down. That's true. But, I mean, yeah. I mean, the death toll could be about similar if, say, a coal mine got hit with a tsunami, you know? So, yeah. But, man, that tsunami was crazy in Japan, you know? Yeah. Speaking of disaster, have you heard about the riots that are happening in London right now?
You know, I have been hearing a bit about it. I don't know much, though.
I don't either. It's like, I don't know much about, you know, who's starting it, why it's going on, you know, but the destruction of it has just been incredible. Because, I mean, Brits, in my mind, have always been the kind of people who are like, yeah, they'll yell and shout and everything, but they're not going to get to that point where they're rioting. I mean, that's something that L.A. and California is known for. That's our specialty. You guys can't have it, you know?
But
that's our specialty.
Haven't you ever heard of a soccer riot?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, soccer riots. But
that's what soccer is for. That's what I thought, you know? And that's why, you know, they don't have to... riot over political stuff, you know?
Yeah, I always see the soccer riots, they happen in the South American countries, you know, where it's like, you know, they sell too many tickets or, you know, people get too drunk and everything.
Maybe that's how these riots start, you know? Maybe it's just about soccer.
maybe it's all just about soccer, yeah. Man United lost against Liverpool and now the whole city is in outrage, right? Yeah, just trash and shit.
I sure hope not, but
yeah.
We can only hope.
I know. It's always the silliest things that cause riots. Like, I think the thing that's most disappointing with L.A. and California in general is when Lakers win a championship and then we celebrate by destroying L.A., you know? I mean, the people, they're such idiots. I mean, you're destroying the city you live in. Like, I could understand you go to Arizona or you go to the enemy city of the people who did win and then you trash their city. But, like, the fact that, you know, like, Shaquille O'Neal has to get on the radio or the TV and says, remember, L.A. celebrates with dignity, you know? We're not... he says he has to tell people, don't flip over cop cars, you know? And it's...
That's pretty cool, though.
Yeah, it is cool, but it's like,
yeah.
I mean, yeah, no doubt about it. If there were riots, I'd be down there grabbing a TV and everything. If there was a riot and it was a state of emergency, what would you grab from stores if looting was just all out? What was the one thing you'd? What was a few things you'd grab?
I don't know. Maybe a nice portable CD player.
Affordable CD player. It's like you can get those for like $20 now.
Yeah.
It's like who uses CDs?
But, that was kind of a joke.
Yeah,
I didn't really have much on my mind at the time.
Affordable
so.
CD player. That's funny. Yeah,
it's like all I want for Christmas.
Forget about. I'm like running past the iPods and the MP3 players and the iPads, and I'm going straight to
that.
The CD players. Right.
That's, yeah, that's what I wanted when I was 9 years old. So
I was thinking about cassette player, but the guy at the store while I was looting it said, "No, go with CD. It's better." Right?
I really enjoy your vinyl, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
I like going too far.
Yeah, I think if I was to loot, I'd go to a Best Buy, which I have worked at. You know, but this is not related. I'm just saying, Best Buy, be warned, I will be there. But no, I'd probably get myself like a projector, you know, like a high definition projector, because those are easy to carry in your two hands.
Oh, certainly. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, or if I had a couple guys with me, get like a big, like 60-inch LCD screen, you know, high definition with the 3D and all that.
Just, and a VHS player?
Yeah, and a VHS player. There we go. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and then a laser disc, and then a laser disc player to put the VCR on top. You know,
yeah, exactly. Exactly.
There we go, playing all the best movies now.
Yeah,
you know,
gotta have your stacks.
Yeah, yeah. You know the thing about you know, laser disc. You know, the one thing about that is that laser disc has the original cuts of Star Wars on there. It's like now if you try to find it on DVD, all it is the special edition cuts with all the shitty CG characters and all that stuff added to it, you know?
True.
And the only place to get the originals is from the Laserdisc or to get it from some of the special edition DVDs, which they just put a print of the Laserdisc version on there, not in enhanced for widescreen. It's like, come on, people. You know, it's basically VHS quality that they're giving on your DVD. It's like, I know George Lucas likes the special editions, but it's like... renownedly known that nobody likes the special editions. Everyone likes the 70s version of it because it looks like it was shot in the 70s. When you've got super CG characters mixed with 70s Harrison Ford, it doesn't quite mix. Like, imagine if they did that with Gone with the Wind. They replaced all those beautiful matte backgrounds with CG backgrounds. And what the hell, they could just add more fire, more, you know, battles happening on in the background. But it takes away from the charm of the original. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, for certain. I mean, that is, yeah. It's ridiculous, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I have never been really a fan of CG. I think even the stuff that Jim Henson was doing was, like, just amazing compared to, like, the CG.
Unbelievable. You look at, like, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, you know? His people did those puppets, and they were amazing. They hold up well for guys in suits and everything, and it worked great, you know?
I mean, I'm a huge fan of that, you know?
Yeah. It's like
I'd rather see one of the, you know, a movie like that than any CG.
Oh, definitely. I mean, the thing about that is, like, no one ever questioned it. No one ever was like, oh, this looks fake or it doesn't look convincing and everything. That always happens with CG, but with puppetry and everything, a lot of the times, you know, with good puppetry and everything, there was never any question about whether it was real or not, you know? Mm-hmm. It worked well for the movie. Even stuff like Legend and, you know, other Jim Henson films like that, you know? It's like, they're really great. They hold up. It's sad that these kind of talented puppeteers don't really get the kind of work that they well deserve. It was like at the Academy Awards, they had, you know, nominations for best makeup effects and everything. And, you know, Rick Baker won because he did the Wolfman movie with Benicio del Toro. And that was the only thing that came out that year which uses prosthetic, you know, makeup effects like that, you know, to really transform a person into a beast, you know? Like everything else was like, you know, there was a period piece and all that. And then there's one... where they made it like Dustin Hoffman and Paul Giamatti age, you know, and look older and everything. Mm-hmm. But there wasn't any of that wow special effects like the Wolfman, you know?
Yeah, I haven't been really keeping up on current movies.
Yeah.
Or the Academy Awards. I don't know.
Well, I mean, yeah. But, you know, like, Academy Awards are one of those things you just have to sort of take into account, you know, when trying to break into the film industry, because it's part of the business. You know, if you want to be part of the business, it's a business, you know? You know, put aside creativity and all that, it's still just a business, you know? And so, I mean, part of the Academy Awards is sort of a popularity contest in that, you know, it's like, who's going to win? Sandra Bullock, of course.
I just think it's all money run. And,
Yeah.
That's why it's like sometimes it's like, wow, you really thought that other movie was going to win, you know? But,
yeah.
I mean, not to say that they don't all deserve it in their own right, you know?
Yeah,
I'd say
yeah.
that anybody really worked harder than the other, but,
yeah,
you know, that's the thing about making movies. It's so much of a process. There's so many things that go into it, you know, and people should, you know,
It's hard to judge, especially because the movies are great in their own right, so it's hard to judge one against the other, you know? Unless maybe they're in similar genres, you know? But other than that, it's hard to do. And, you know, I was actually surprised that The King's Speech won last year's Academy Awards because, like, not a lot of people saw that, you know? So it was surprising for an indie flick like that to really win over The Social Network, which was, you know, from Sony, David Fincher, Aaron Sorkin, had a big release, big cast, you know? And yeah, it didn't win. I was like, man, I was surprised. But I don't know, maybe I have to see The King's Speech, and maybe it is a better film, you know? I'd have to say. Did you see any of last year's Academy Award nominees?
I really could not even recall.
Okay, well, here, I can maybe list them off. Did you see The Social Network?
No.
Okay, did you see The King's Speech?
No.
The Fighter?
No.
127 Hours?
No.
Winter's Bone?
Yeah.
Winter's Bone was good, wasn't it?
Winter's Bone was good.
Yeah.
I like that.
I was surprised how good that was. Toy Story 3?
No, I didn't see that one either. I've been meaning to watch that.
Toy Story 3 is good. I'm surprised because, you know, your mom runs a daycare center and they have kids around. I'm sure that would be...
I'm not here all the time. So.
That's true, yeah.
Or
yeah.
ever, if yeah. I can help it.
And, what else was there? The Kids Are Alright? Did you see that one?
Nope.
And see, what am I missing out? I've got 7 on my fingers, and there's 10. What am I missing? Help me out here, Evan. What am I missing?
Oh, shit. I have no idea, Doc.
Okay, well, I got 7 out of those, you know? So, yeah. I mean, I think I've seen most of them. I think the only ones I haven't seen were... It was The Fighter at a Time. I didn't see that one. And then I haven't seen 127 Hours or The King's Speech, you know?
Wasn't there a new Terminator movie?
There was, yeah, in like 2009. It was Terminator Salvation. Did you see that one?
Don't think I saw that one either.
No. That one, it kind of sucked a little bit because it was supposed to be about the future John Connor. You know, you've seen the other Terminator films, right? Did you see Terminator 3?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, like, this was supposed to be about adult John Connor, you know, sort of like when you see him in the, you know, in the flashback moments of, or the future moments in Terminator 2, you know, where you see him, he's grown up, he's leading the army and all that, he's leading the revolution and all that stuff. But this one was the movie just before he becomes head of the revolution. In this one, he's just a grunt soldier in the sort of army, you know, and he's like, hey guys, I know what's going to happen because I have visions from the future. And everyone's like, yeah, whatever, John Connor, I know you've been right about everything in the past, but we're not going to believe you on this one, you know?
Not this time, John Connor.
They do that thing that they always do in like war movies where it's like, shut up, Mr. Scientist. I'm the general and I'm going to kill everything, you know? I don't have to listen to you or, you know, the guy who wants to, like, preserve the natives and all that. It's like, oh, fuck that. I'm going to just destroy that forest, you know? Like Avatar.
Independence Day.
Yeah, Independence Day. Yeah, you get the trigger-happy generals and all that, and they just, like, go all at it, you know? So it kind of worked that way out. And, but yeah. Shit, what movie was that time? Oh, yeah, Terminator Salvation, yeah. There is one scene which is absolutely unforgivable in that movie where John Connor, he wants to meet up with the head of the, you know, rebellion, basically the generals in charge, but they're in a submarine underwater, okay? And so he tells the helicopter pilot, they're going over the ocean, and he's like, yeah, right about here, just drop me off here. He jumped out of the helicopter into the water and somehow makes it into a moving submarine without anybody really noticing, and they're like, God damn it, John Connor, that was a reckless move. You would have given away our position, just like that. And it's like, how the fuck do you get on a submarine? I thought fucking everything's been destroyed from the... you can't even do that now. And now we're in a society which is perfectly, like, well-formed and everything. We got everything going on. The military's okay. We're not in the time of a crisis war. And we can't do that now. But in the future, they can perfectly do that, you know?
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I hope so. I know. Because, like, that, I mean, submarines seem like, you know, more but than...
The thing about it, it's a post-apocalyptic future. We got hit by surprise by robot rebellion, you know?
That's why making movies is, like, such an amazing process, because... You know, doesn't really rely on the most adequate points of the process for a decent revenue.
I like what you hit on there with sometimes all you need is a good trailer to get people through the door, and that's true. I mean, a lot of times movies will have great trailers but horrible movies, you know? Totally. It's like a lot of times you just get fucked with the trailer, like the Indiana Jones, the latest one. That one had a great trailer, terrible movie. You know, Transformers 3 had a good trailer, terrible movie. And sometimes it works out all right, you know, like The Devil's Double. We saw the trailer for that, and that was insane, you know? And the movie was also equally insane. I mean, it was not a perfect movie and everything, but it was still had all those great moments in the trailer, and it was really added to it.
And that's the reality of trailers, is they are made to make you want to get in. So it's like they will sell you on any point that they can, and that's their job, and, you know, that's the point of it. And, you know,
oh, yeah.
It's beneficial for the project if you can make a good trailer. Yeah,
it's the same thing. I mean,
the audience, you have to know what to expect.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, it's very rare that you have a shitty trailer and a good movie. It's always like, if the trailer doesn't interest you, the movie won't interest you, you know? Although sometimes it does work that way. Like, Thor, the trailer didn't interest me, and then the movie, I ended up seeing it, and pretty much, I kind of liked it okay, you know? It wasn't too bad. But, yeah, sometimes, like,
You ever see a trailer and think you're going to watch some movie, and then it ends up being a completely different kind of movie?
Oh my god, that happens so much.
It's like, what the heck was that trailer about? Like, that was a completely different movie than what happened at all.
It's so true. It's like the old switcheroo type thing, you know? It's like, a lot of times they pump up the action in it, and then the movie just turns out to be a straight drama, you know?
Yeah.
You know, like, where's the action happening, you know? I thought we were gonna see more of that. It was like the same thing with, like, say, Hot Fuzz, you know? Hot Fuzz, I went in knowing I'm going to like it already, but the trailer was just all about the action and everything and the, you know, kicking ass and cops kicking ass. And then you see the movie, it's like straight comedy and sort of a mystery horror drama up until the end part where it just starts shooting out and everything, you know? It's like,
wow, there's got to be some, like, you know, study about that, some sort of statistic that, like, backs that.
It's just, like, straight up, like, weird marketing, you know? It's like, they did that with that movie Jarhead, you know, with Jake Gyllenhaal, where he's a Marine, and the trailer just showed all the cool action parts of it, and then you watch the movie, and it's just, like, the movie is about him being a Marine, but not being able to do anything. There's no real action, there's always just preparation, sitting around, and everything like that. And it's like, man, I feel bad for the people who went into that movie thinking it'd be something else, you know? Especially when it, like, it seems to follow up plot or storyline, and then it just barely gets mentioned in the movie, you know?
Yeah.
I think worst thing is they can do is when they get a good joke in a movie, but they just play it constantly, you know? They just constantly just throw it in your face all the time, you know?
You know what I saw the other day?
What?
Horrible Bosses.
Horrible Bosses. I saw that one, too. It was pretty good. I was surprised, you know? It wasn't...
Motherfucking Jones.
Yeah, Motherfucking Jones.
I love that. That was great.
Yeah, Jamie Foxx in there was good. Oh my god. He's just like a white-collar criminal who's giving out murder advice.
Genius,
yeah. It wasn't a movie that had tons of jokes in it, but it was just a fun movie because you liked the characters. It all made perfectly sense. There wasn't any moments where it's like, what is that doing in the movie? That doesn't fit at all, you know, tone-wise. I think tone is the hardest thing to get right in comedy movies, you know?
Yeah, definitely. It had a good flow, you know? It was decent, you know?
Kevin Spacey I loved in there as the horrible boss, you know? I love that scene in the beginning where he makes Jason Bateman drink that scotch, like, 8 in the morning, you know? He's like, you want to drink 18-year-old scotch? He's like, all right, I'll have one. And then, like, doesn't pour one for himself. He's like, well, I'm not an alcoholic, Mitch, you know?
Exactly. I mean, and in my, you know, instance, like, I didn't even see a trailer. I didn't know what I was going to go see. Didn't. I just knew it was kind of a comedy, you know? And so I was really stoked, you know? It was a great movie.
Yeah. It's like a lot of times,
not knowing what to expect.
Yeah. A lot of times with movies like that, you can just kind of rely on the cast, you know? To be good in that sense, because You know, it's got Jason Bateman and Kevin Spacey, Jennifer Aniston, Colin Farrell, Jason Sudeikis. Jennifer Aniston was hot in that movie, wasn't she? She was so fun.
Still doing it. She's...
I know. Still good. And it was great because she wasn't playing the same character she always plays. You know, she always kind of plays the naggy, bitchy girlfriend or love interest or whatever. And this one was like a kind of a flip for her. You know, she was playing something that she doesn't usually play. I think...
I could see her in that role more often.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know.
We'll see, you know. We'll see in the future.
Yeah.
She might stick with this, this type of...
Yeah, it made me forget that she is
still
a yeah, she is still a talented actress. But it's like it sucks when you get good actors in a movie, but they don't really get anything to do. Like they're underutilized, and you can really tell, you know.
Yeah,
it's like it seems like it's one of those sets where someone had a good idea, and then the director just said no, shut them down, you know. And it's like, oh man, that always kills the mood, and I'm sure it kills the mood and creativity on the set. You know, it was like Kevin Smith was talking about that with his movie Cop Out. The one he did with Bruce Willis and Tracy Morgan, and he said it should have been great. I had Bruce Willis in the movie, I had Tracy Morgan, it should have been, like, Tracy Morgan, he said, was an angel, you know, totally fun, willing to experiment, work with him and everything, but Bruce Willis was not doing anything with him, you know? It's like, he'd tell him to hit his mark, and he'd just walk over the mark, and it's like, Bruce Willis, you've been doing this for 20-plus years, how come you're not hitting the mark? And then he just realized that this guy just doesn't want to be here. He doesn't want to do anything that Kevin Smith wanted him to do and just didn't want to be a part of it, you know? And the crew could kind of tell it, and just I'm sure it just kills the morale on something that should be creative and fun for everybody. And then it turned out to be a shitty movie, you know? It's like,
well, that's the thing about the director-actor relationship. It's like, I mean, he should be able to know, like, 100% what's going on with his actor, you know?
So, yeah. Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And if you don't have that, then, I mean, and a lot of movies are, you know, banked on that one A-list actor that can make their, you know, movie sell, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, you have to have that as a director or else it's just going to make the whole process tough and exactly, you're not,
because
you're not going to be happy at the end. It's
because I always hear a story about, like, some actors, they just need the right director to push them in the right direction. Otherwise, they're rebellious because, you know, it's sort of like, because A-list actors, they're used to being the alpha male on set. You know, like Jim Carrey, he knows, I can quit this movie and you're not going to find another Jim Carrey, you know? I'm in charge here because I'm the one holding this thing together, you know? So sometimes they take that a little too far to the point where they become the director on the set. They become the one calling these shots, and the director just sits back like, yeah, just let Bruce Willis do whatever he needs to do, you know, whatever, I don't care anymore. You know, obviously I don't have as much a say in this as I wish I did. And, you know, then producers, they won't back up the director. No one will back up the director because they need that star to stay in there, even if it is turning a good script into a shitty movie. And that's kind of... It's kind of sad because, like, a lot of times you can see movies that have good potential and they don't really reach that potential, you know?
Oh, certain. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, that movie Bad Teacher should have been a much better film. I mean, it had Cameron Diaz, it had Jason Segel, had Justin Timberlake. You know, Cameron Diaz was playing against type, being the bad teacher and everything. And it had the director of Walk Hard and Orange County. That guy was directing it. It should have been great, you know, especially with studio financing, big stars, and everything like that. And it just turned out to be a flop. It just fizzled, died, you know, felt watered down. And it's like the kind of thing where either, you know, the actors don't give it their all or they just get undercut by producers and writers and everything like that.
I think that's the thing with a movie. It's like there's so many steps to the whole process. Any one of those steps that, you know, it falters or...
Yeah,
you know, fails, you know, then you really have, you know, a do or die situation. Where is it more, you know, profitable to try to make a little bit of cash back on this, or you know, call it a flop and try to get out as fast as you can? You know, sometimes I'm sure it happens like that. You know, with the financiers, they want to see something back. You know, and
yeah, especially
you know, so you've got those contracts that you can't really. already you gotta pay him, you know, so
and I really
being
think
a producer must be real tough, you know. I don't really necessarily want to be a producer myself, but
yeah,
I do produce at times.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind doing that because, you know, I like movies and everything, but I know that I have limitations creativity wise that other people probably have more of, you know. And so I think a producer's real job is just make sure they have the money, make sure everyone shows up on set, make sure everything's taken care of, you know? Sort of like the host of a party, but not someone who's the party is for, you know? And it's really, it's because movies, they have to be from a singular vision. They can't have 10 people writing the script with 10 people's views on it, because then it just turns out to be shit, you know? Turns out to be something no one wants to see because it doesn't have a singular vision going into it, you know?
And the producer just has to know what he wants. He has to be right on it with the director.
Yeah.
And, you know, director's got to be right there with the actors.
I think one producer who does pretty well is Jerry Bruckheimer, you know, because he's made a lot of great movies like The Rock and Con Air and Armageddon and everything, where he just sort of, he sets everything up, you know, makes sure the director has everything they need, and just says to the director, go direct, go make this movie, you know. He just trusts them. He trusts, you know, people like Michael Bay to make Armageddon, you know, and he trusts directors like Simon West to make Con Air, you know. And
look at how they fucked it up. Con Air was great.
Con Air is an underrated film. You know, it's like, if you haven't seen Con Air, it's a good action movie.
I just can't think of Armageddon without singing Aerosmith. So that's where.
I gotta do. Well, how's the song go? What was it?
I don't wanna miss a thing.
And I don't want to miss a thing.
Exactly.
Right?
Even when I think of you.
Sweetest thing I ever do.
Yeah, not bad. Yeah.
Mm. I know, right? That movie ended up being, because of that movie, ended up being Aerosmith's number one song. Their first number one. You know, they never made it to the charts of number one. And this was the first time, because of that movie, that they made it to number one.
That seems odd.
Yeah, it definitely does, because Aerosmith's been around for ages, and it's like, Aerosmith, everyone knows them, but they had never had a number one hit until that movie came out. And that's pretty crazy, don't you think, for Aerosmith?
America's, and I quote, greatest rock band.
Yeah, yeah.
They are great, but, you know, greatest is it's a lot of America out there.
Well, here, let's kind of move back to music in a bit, and, you know, the thing I've noticed is that if you mention such bands as like U2, Bruce Springsteen, and Bob Dylan, it's kind of bands, or Coldplay, or Black Eyed Peas, it's bands that it seems like everybody loves, you know? And it's the thing about art in general is that if everybody loves something, it's not that great, because you can't make something that appeals to everybody and still have a true singular vision.
I guess there is some sort of, it's just an approach, you know, and really, an artist can, you know, just be found in their time, you know, and be progressive, yet, you know, for all time. And you know, I mean, I have my personal favorites and things that drive me to be more artistic, but then I can also appreciate the fact that a great song is a great song for...
That's true.
You know, for everybody, you know? I really appreciate that fact. As a songwriter and as a, you know, producer and doing all that, all the music.
Yeah, but it's like, say U2, they're a good band, no doubt about it. They're talented, but they don't excite me, you know, in that sense, because it's just something that, it's like, it'd be something that they'd listen on KBIG, you know? Or one of those, you know, it's the at work station, which is everybody loves. So it's just kind of, I don't know, it just doesn't feel like it has any attitude or grit behind it, you know?
Yeah,
so definitely. This kind of things with, like, some bands. It's sort of those bands that it's easy to be a fan of, you know? It doesn't light that fire inside you.
I think, you know, I used to be a little more pretentious about music and liking a certain thing. But music... There's music for every moment, you know. There's you know, a time to, you know, party. There's a time to relax and recollect. There's times to just, enjoy it.
I think with music, the general rule is if your parents like them, then they're not cool, you know.
Well, at some points, but my parents really liked Pink Floyd, and
I agree.
Yeah.
Wow, that's rare. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I know most parents are like, yeah, I like, you know. Coldplay and U2 and all that, and Bruce Springsteen, and it's like, yeah, no doubt, they're all talented people, but it's just like, they like it, they're not as cool as they used to be, you know?
Yeah. My mom really liked the guy that did, Shaggy, Mr. Boombastic.
Shaggy?
Oh, yeah, God. She really likes, Shaggy, I never understood that, but, yeah. I mean, you know, it's good, it makes, hey.
Shaggy was great, he landed
I know the
on
song.
His, he landed on his feet, right?
Yeah.
He's doing well, right?
I guess at times, you know, it makes sense, so I guess you gotta
love it. That's the kind of thing,
it.
Like, you can tell somebody really has lasting power, because, you know, if they can keep putting out new music and still be relevant, then they're a good band, but if they have that one hit, and then that's all they can do, they're like a one-trick pony, and that's all they got, you know?
And yeah, maybe not so talented as we all expected.
Yeah, you know, there's been a couple bands that I was like, you know, a song would come out by them and it was really good and you really expected there to be another one. But it's so hard to keep a band together. And I think that's like probably one of the reasons why it's like it's tough to make the music that you want, you know, with other people. It's
yeah, and it's the same thing with like say Beastie Boys, you know, constantly with their new albums and everything, they sort of keep like, you know, reinventing themselves in a sense, you know, where they come out with new stuff. It doesn't sound like the old stuff, but it still has a bit of that old, you know, flavor in it and everything. And yeah, they're always coming out with great music. It's like those one of those bands that'll just keep going and going and going because they know they're talented. You know, if something doesn't work out, they can say, yeah, don't worry, I got a million other songs I could do, you know?
Yeah. I mean, in the end, you know, you find what works and you work on it. And
yeah.
And it might not, you know, it just, you just got to do it for the love of it. You know, you got to do it because you got to know that every day you're going to be creating, making music, making film, doing art, doing whatever you do. You guys got to be dedicated to the process.
Speaking of creating music, are you working on anything solo related or is it just Reason to Rebel right now?
Oh, well, a couple years back, I had a band where called Ghost Frequency of Calathea, and my brother was in the band. All my real good buddies from back in the day in the band. So I had about 8 people in the band. We made this record, and you know, it came out. Well, you know, it hasn't come out yet, but it's coming out.
Are you still in sort of a band with those guys, or have you just disbanded?
No, it didn't last too long, but we recorded the record, and I did a couple other tracks even after the band was done with members of the band, so that's going to be all together, all the Ghost Frequency of Calathea, and, you know, it might be released on vinyl, we'll see.
Nice.
Kind of want to put it out. I got... Basically, the art's done. I'm just waiting to have a little bit of extra cash to put it out, you know. So that's where that's going. But you know,
when you put music on iTunes, does it cost you money to put it out on iTunes?
I really haven't delved into that, but you know, I kind of leave that. You know, that's not really what I do for. Reason to Rebel.
Who controls the business end of that for Reason to Rebel?
That's Luke mainly, and he has other people working on the website. You know, probably will eventually be in charge of the website at some point, or at least have a little bit of control over that. But as far as it's going right now, I'm just making the videos, you know, and playing guitar, writing some songs.
Nice. Yeah. Do you have any new songs for Reason to Rebel that's coming out? I mean, I know you got the album, but besides that, but like, say stuff you haven't recorded yet. You have something you really want to get into the studio and record?
Yeah, you know, since it's the whole recording process takes months, it's like there has been new things I've been kind of, you know, picking at, but it seems like my backlog of riffs and ideas are, you know, I'm almost ready to write something new at any moment, you know. There's has been a style that we've been going towards, wow, got a lot of music there, you know? There's a lot of music yet to be played, and it's real good, you know?
Here's another thing. Disney just recently canceled their reboot of The Lone Ranger. Have you heard of The Lone Ranger?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, you know, it's Lone Ranger and his sidekick Tonto and everything, They were going to spend about $250 million to bring that to the big screen. And they had Johnny Depp as Tonto, the Indian. And then they had Armie Hammer, who played the Winklevoss twins in The Social Network. He was going to be the Lone Ranger. And so he's kind of a buff, in-shape, white guy, young guy and everything. And good actor. Definitely a great actor, you know? And so it would have been interesting to see. But then it's sort of that thing. It's like, who nowadays in 2011 gives a shit about the Lone Ranger, you know? It's like, it's one of those franchises. Like, it was popular at its time. What was that, like 1950s, 1960s or so? It was at the height of its popularity back then. And then they decided now, hey, let's reboot it. Let's bring it Lone Ranger to the big screen. But it's like, and then the new head of Disney just, you know, woke up and realized, wait a minute, nobody cares about Lone Ranger and Tonto, and this is not going to go well, you know? It's sort of like the Smurfs movie, you know? They made the Smurfs movie, but it's like, who in this day and age remembers the Smurfs in its original form, you know, as cartoon and was actually a big fan of the Smurfs?
Yeah, that's has been a theory. I forgot the person who came up with this, that everything will be reinvented and we will lose the original source of the idea of it. And
they're constantly doing that. It's like
in the end, you know, we're gonna lose touch with, you know, with the original author of things, and you know, in the end, we'll think that
Just look at it. I mean, it happened with the
process.
Yeah, I mean, look at the Green Hornet movie. It took a completely different direction than the original. The original was more like, say, Batman based, you know, where he's a guy, he dressed undercover, fights crime. But Green Hornet just took it in a completely different direction. It was like, what were they thinking with that? I mean, they did it with Smurfs. They did it with Arthur, you know, the remake of Arthur. It's like the original was from the '80s. People who are fans of that, why would they want to see a remake of that? You know.
And yeah, it is kind of crazy that I'm seeing like more and more of that in music though too. Like riffs that were, I mean, there is sampling.
They're doing a lot of that,
but there is also bands that are like making songs that are just the, I mean, that's been happening for a long time, but just the same, you know, just the same riff, you know. It's
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, there's very famously, Nickelback did that recently with one of their songs. You know, I can't remember the name of the songs, but there was that one that was like, "You remind me of what I want to do." You know, that one.
Okay.
And then there was another one which sounded just the same, and someone even synced it up together. Like, one headphone had their original song, and then the other had their new song. And you sync them up and listen to them, and they sound exactly the same. They got the same guitar riffs. And everything. It's like,
Green Day has written the same song. Like,
really?
I don't know. Like, a lot of just songs, it's just fall into place like that, you know, and you can't, like, you blame it on, you know, writer's
writer's block, yeah.
Consent, or I think, like, respect for the artist, you know, but it's like, it gets to the point where it's like, you already wrote that song.
Yeah.
And it's like, write something different, you know, or you know, change or something, something that'll keep the attention. But a lot of artists, you know, will just get almost smaller and weaker in their creativity and their ability to do something that's like
outside the box. It's sort of that second album curse, because, you know, the first album that the bands always have, it's always, you know, it's songs they've been cataloging for their entire career, and now it's coming out, you know, it's got all the great songs in there, and then everybody loves it, and then they're like, okay, what's the second album? And then they're like, we just blew our load on the first one. We just gave everything to the first album. And then on the second album, you know, I mean, not usually it's going to be a bit weaker than the first one.
Well, oftentimes it's like, that's true too. If a band will get some sort of really quick success,
they
might be picked up by a label, and then they might have all this manager who's telling them to do this then. And it gets to the point where they are not in control. They don't have time to write. You know, obviously, it's a different ballpark, you know, and that's kind of sad about, you know, because they probably would have done just fine if they found a friend to be their manager, or, you know, someone that knew a little bit of something instead of going under, you know, and that's changing a lot.
But, like, the manager would be like, okay, we need the song in an Old Navy commercial by tomorrow, you know?
Yeah, so, well, like, we'll need a new album out by, you know, this summer so we can tour, you know, so we can play all these big festivals.
Oh,
and, you know, it's like,
when they rush it to get a release date, it hardly ever turns out
well. Well, this is the process. They'll, like, you know, maybe write, like, 10, 15, whatever, 20 songs, and then someone else will decide what songs to take, you know, and oftentimes they'll be like, you know what, all this is crap. Play these songs that we just bought the copyrights for, or we have our own writers in, and, you know, they'll work out a deal to get the copyrights to whoever, you know.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's gnarly, you know, the whole business side of it. And I think, you know, letting a band just be a band, you know, if they had something good, you know, that's probably better for them, you know, instead of
if you got something going well, you know, it's like, you know, why change it, you know?
It's like, I mean, business will help art, but in a lot of ways, you know, it hinders an artist, you know, and it's that stuff, you know.
Yeah, especially, you know, you always see those bands that, you know, everyone says they sell out, but they're not really selling out. What they're doing is deciding to become profitable, you know. And, you know, they'll say to sell, oh, look, they got their commercial in a JC, they got their song in a JCPenney ad. It's like, well, good. I mean, they didn't have to really change their song, and now they're making money off a JCPenney ad. So, like, the people who say, oh, you sold out, it's not a fair assumption to say they sold out, because they are, like, say, Green Day. A lot of people say they sold out when they started, when they had their new album, Bullet in the Bible, you know, come out in, like, 2002, because they changed up their sound. Before, you know, Billy Joel used to be going with that sort of monotonous singing voice, you know, where it just sort of, he stays the same, doesn't really change his tone much. And then they came out with a new album, which was different, and it ended up winning the Grammy for Best Rock Album. And then some people were like, they sold out. It's like, no, they're still making their music. Fans are still
coming
out. Well,
the thing about that album is it was produced very well.
I mean, yeah.
Like, and that's what I've been coming to realize as I've been growing up and being more of a process of within the recording process and the editing.
Yeah.
There's so many other things that are beyond a band's control.
Uh huh.
If a producer can, you know, make a band sound like they're playing in a stadium arena, I mean, that's what they can do. I mean, if they can make you sound like the hardest shit, you know, and they can do that, you know, and it's,
yeah,
it doesn't matter if you hit it harder or you just got to play in time and you got to get your shit tight and you go into the studio and you record it and like as clean as possible. And then a lot of it's not really up to you anymore. It's up to what's good for the song and for the, you know, so a lot of things that, you know, that you might have thought, you know, are going to be different, but it's usually for the better, you know, or whatever, you know. Making a great song is really hard, and great production is very hard to do.
Oh,
and that's the thing about that Green Day record. It was produced very well.
It definitely
was. It hits hard. And,
Well, one thing I found that kind of annoys me, I don't know if it annoys you and everything, but they do this a lot with pop songs, is where they have a great female singer, but they do the thing where they layer her voice like five times, so it sounds like five of the same singer are singing, you know, like Gwen Stefani on that song Rich Girl. It was just like seven of her singing at once, and it's like, it sounds good, but then you can tell, like, it's not as strong as it would be if it just had a singular singer, you know, and then when they perform it live on stage or in an award show, it just never sounds as good as when they layer it like seven times. And I'm thinking, you know, if someone was a strong singer, you don't need all that, you know, you don't need all the bells and whistles to really promote them.
Well, a great producer definitely knows when to hold back and to give the artist their reins, you know? And
he can probably tell if they're a weak singer, like if you got Kesha, you know, who's like, ugh. And then, you know, they can just auto-tune the hell out of her and then make her sound good, you know?
So they kind of just know what they're working with. But yeah, it's like when you're a singer and you've got seven of you singing on the same track, then you can kind of tell maybe they're not that great of a singer, you know?
Yeah. It helps at points, you know, but...
Yeah. I can imagine, I know, like, you know, it's been gone over before, but you know when you have singers like Lady Gaga and Kesha who do the whole appearance thing, they've got the costumes and the wild set pieces and all this sort of distractions that distract you from the actual singing and the song. I'm sure, like, real singers like, you know, like Adele or, you know, the other, like, strong, powerful singers like that, like the diva-type singers, you know, they look at them like, oh, she's one of those singers. She's one of the ones that'll, you know, be a pop sensation for a year or so, and then they'll just die out because everyone will sort of look past that. They'll grow older than that, and they'll look past the facade of, you know, the fancy hair, the costumes, the set pieces, all the gimmicks and everything, and realize that they're not a strong singer. They're a weak singer with a bunch of flair, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to be up on stage as it is, you know, and I think a lot of people will almost hide behind their costumes, but I'm not saying that about any artist. I mean, being an artist and in your own right and being, you know, in fact, the reality is, you know, however much of a costume you have, if you're really singing and really performing, like dancing at the whole thing, then you are an artist, you know, and that is, you know, your show.
Oh yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And it's you know, tough to say because a lot of artists will hide behind, you know, the new thing or the trendy thing, or they'll kind of get lost in that, and then you won't know about them exactly after a year or two.
Yeah.
You know, all of a sudden they're just, you know,
it's
back
sort of,
to nobody, you know, which is
sort
tough,
of,
you know?
Sort of like Kiss, you know? Kiss, they got a big following because they were big, flashy, amazing shows, costumes, and all that. But, you know, compared, like, music-wise, say, to Pink Floyd, not as strong, you know? I mean, Kiss is great in their own right. You know, yeah. Everyone loves Kiss in their own way. I mean, I like Kiss, even though I know it's sort of like a guilty pleasure type thing with Kiss. You know. Yeah. I mean, what do you think of Kiss?
I like Kiss a lot. Yeah. But
I do too.
But it's exactly. I mean, it's not like it's about this. It's about the show. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they definitely have their records, and that's, you know, they're still a band in their own right, and it takes a lot of work to be a band. It takes a whole lifetime, a whole career. You have to have dedication. Oh, yeah. You have to lose yourself within that, you know, and that's how you'll make it. And, you know, a little bit of, you know, dressing up doesn't hurt, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, if I would be in that situation, I would find it monotonous to have to wear the same thing and to promote myself as the same thing all the time, like I'm a robot that cannot change or anything like that. I mean, I'm not just not that person, you know. I mean, but you know, then again, he might feel, you know, very comfortable with that. I'm not saying that I cannot understand him or but
I can imagine that, like, every time you have to go on stage, you have to spend 3 hours in makeup to get, like, your face painted or your hair done, and the costume you have to fit into those, you know, those foot-tall platform shoes.
Exactly. And I enjoy doing that for acting, you know. I enjoy putting the thing on, but being on stage, you know, it's hot, sweaty, you gotta worry about your guitar being in tune and doing the whole show.
I can imagine that. Cool. Like, I would get so nervous on stage performing that all the paint would just start melting off my face and just sweating down. I'd have, like, the running mascara look going on.
I've seen it.
My demon child face.
I've been there, actually. Yeah.
Have you ever performed with your face painted?
Yeah, for one show we played, Halloween.
Oh, okay. What were you painted as?
I was actually Edgar Allan Poe.
Oh, okay.
And we were playing at the Whiskey a Go-Go. And up in Hollywood. And, it was a lot of fun, you know. I had a raven, like, basically glued to the head of my guitar.
Oh.
And, and I had some, like, dark circles, like, around my eyes. And, and so I had all these, like, my face was all melting.
it was like the eye makeup underneath your eyes was running as if you're crying and your mascara is running.
It was pretty awesome. I think it really worked with the costume.
Oh yeah, definitely. It was awesome. You look like a sad Edgar Allan Poe now.
Dude,
right?
It was the shit. It was rad. Yeah. I had the mustache and everything.
Oh, nice. Well, was the mustache running as well?
Yeah.
No. Oh no, that was your real mustache.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I thought you painted on like Edgar Allan.
Well, I did. I did spray. I did paint it.
Oh, you colored it black?
Yeah, black.
Oh, okay. That's funny. Oh, my God.
That stayed.
That's like another Spinal Tap moment that you have with your band. It's like, oh, great, the raven fell off my guitar this time. Exactly. You know?
Dude, that
I can't
so
play
cool.
without the raven.
That was so cool.
Yeah. You should have just had it on your shoulder like a parrot, you know, like a pirate would do. Did you have the whole costume? Were you playing in Edgar Allan Poe's, like, outfit?
Yeah.
Oh, because
just wore black. And just
he had, like, a heavy coat and everything, right? Yeah, so, oh, man, that must have been hot.
It was pretty rad.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, it's, like, it's sort of like the same thing as, like, at Comic-Con, you know? It's, like, you go there and you're walking around all day, and I see these guys in their Ghostbuster outfits. They've got the full Ghostbusters jumpsuit, head to toe, you know, arms, sleeves, pants, and everything, and they're carrying this proton pack, which has to weigh about 50 pounds. On their back, you know, which is made of full metal. It's all authentic looking because they actually have chapters. They're like the Ghostbusters of San Diego.
Wow.
You know? Yeah, so they have Ghostbusters of every city. Yeah. And I think, okay, that's awesome, but that's got to suck wearing that whole thing because also you're carrying your bag full of shit that you pick up, you know? There's so much giveaways and everything. It's like, how do you spend the whole day wearing full, like, army boots and, like, the jumpsuit and the proton pack and then carrying your bag of stuff? It's like you got to be the sweatiest Ghostbuster. You know,
Slimer.
Over there, yeah. It's like, yeah, you got hit with slime. You could just say that, you know. I got slime by just going to Comic-Con. Yeah, it's like costumes are great, but it's like, damn. It was like I told you, you know, I went to when I was down there. This one guy had a centaur outfit, a full centaur, you know, and he even had the legs at the back working.
Wow,
to give him that full horse look. It's like, oh my god, that is amazing. It's got to be weird standing in line for something, you know, or like trying to get seats at, like, you know, one of the panels.
Imagine me on stage in a centaur.
No, dude, you should totally do that.
Yeah.
It's like in Spinal Tap. Remember when David St. Hubbin's girlfriend comes along? She's like, you should all be wearing masks and like dresses like, you know, members of the Zodiac and all
exactly.
that. Exactly. Yeah. That's what you guys need. You need a Yoko to break up the band and ruin everything.
Well, let's hope not.
Yeah. Have you guys ever done any sort of elaborate sort of stage pieces like, you know, Spinal Tap did with Stonehenge and stuff like that?
I don't know. I can't really say. We have had other guests up come up on stage, but I wouldn't say.
Oh, okay.
I wouldn't say anything is crazy.
But nothing stage set wise, more like performer wise. You got like a guest appearance and stuff on your tracks and all that.
Yeah. Have some people come up on stage. Yeah. That's always cool. We've
Oh, you mean like fans are on stage?
That happens too.
Oh, yeah. Nice. Yeah. Anything
but I was interesting? Thinking, but
what happens
artists,
with the fans like, when they get on stage? Does security come and take them off, or do you let them stay around and dance on stage? Or
sometimes it doesn't matter. Sometimes security is there, but you know, sometimes it doesn't matter.
What's the worst you've ever seen security act towards a fan?
Not really at my shows. I mean, I've seen people get hurt in the crowd. You know.
Yeah. I know, like, my friend, he went to a show, or my brother went to a show, and his friend got on stage, and as soon as he got on stage, the lead guitarist kicked him in the back off the stage. Just booted him off the stage. I was like, holy shit. And then, it was crazy. But luckily, there was a crowd below, and they sort of caught him, like, and he ended up crowd surfing in a bit, you know?
I'm sure he enjoyed that.
Yeah, he did like doing that.
In the end, that was all right.
Yeah. All right, well, yeah, I think right here is a good place to wrap up for now. Any last thoughts about anything you want to get off your chest or talk about?
No. just want to say, hey, sorry, cut it short yesterday, but
yeah,
at least I was able to stay on for the full one.
Yeah, no worries. Yeah, you're working a band member, so you got to do your stuff, you know? You got to edit those videos and everything.
Definitely.
That's
look
all
up,
very important.
Look up Reason to Rebel on YouTube.
Oh, yeah.
I got some videos I'm posting just right now, so so check us out. Choreo Cut Productions, Ghost Freak, F-R-E-Q, Freak, all one word. So yeah, check me out. Yeah, I'm all over the place, all online. You know, Evan Jones, Reason to Rebel.
Yeah.
Look me up.
So next time we'll see you. I'm not sure when I'll be recording, but it should be great. And yeah, so you guys have a week. Once again, I'm Shane Pithla. This is my guest.
Evan Jones
from Reason to Rebel. Find him on the internet. And we'll see you later.
Have a good time. Right,
bye.